One last day of existential love.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
These terms are just so pretentious, aren't they? The reality is they have meaning, and they're important terms, especially the word existential. It's just such a coffee shop word, you know. It's a real existential crisis, you know what I mean? And we just throw out the word without thinking about what it means, and it just sounds so much cooler than a crisis of existence or something like that. But it's more than that. In this case, it's the philosophy, and we talked about it a little bit in the first of these three episodes that comprise this discussion about Augustine, Plato, Augustine, Hannah Arendt, and this impact it ought to have on how we think about living out our lives in the world. I'm doing this very succinctly as a reflection after having read her book about Augustine. So Augustine and Love, or Love and St. Augustine is the name of the book, from Hannah Arendt, and then having read Augustine's Confessions, in which he's dealing with a few of the same ideas. Obviously, she's wrestling with some of those ideas herself. So anyway, and then I began to wrestle with the ideas, and so now you're just getting my overflow from having read those materials. Okay, so we've talked about it for 2 days already, sort of laid a metaphysical, if nothing else, foundation, talking about Plato and Augustine and her. And then last time, we were discussing laying down this possibility that love could be more than simple interdependency, that it could be more than living out the libertarian ideal of a free economy with a free market, and even with the sort of familial exchanges of mutual concern and all that kind of shared interest in how we live together, that love might be more than that. Gives us an opportunity to consider something that we might neglect overall otherwise. So consider that. Consider what the idea that love might be more than interdependency. And again, if I just said that neutrally out of nowhere, I would expect you to go, why on earth would you even think love could be interdependency? But that's why we had episode 2 of this 3-part series. So you can go back and listen to that rather than me repeating all of it if you need to, or you can ferret it out from the things we'll be talking about today. So consider what that possibility, that love could be more than interdependency, means for the barrier to a resolution of our selfish existence in the world. That is, if we want to look at the way the world actually looks to us, which is pretty selfish, pretty entirely selfish, then finding how to get out of that selfishness is almost impossible. And then somebody introduces this concept of love that says, well, this isn't a normal part of the system that you're thinking of. Maybe it's a route out of this miserable morass of selfishness that we have found ourselves, in which we found ourselves encumbered. So without the understanding of the difference between that sort of natural interdependency that we were talking about is exemplified in a free market. It's not contained in the free market. It's all of the interdependency we have. It's all of the benefit I have by relating to other people and all that kind of stuff. If we don't understand the difference between that natural interdependency that we have with other people, which can make us extremely grateful for them and can give us a love for them, It can give us a relationship with them. That can be given a literal designation of love. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But if we don't understand the difference between that kind of natural interdependency kind of love and then a supernatural love, the kind of caritas, using the Augustinian word, that we could have if our attention were drawn to Christ, for instance, or maybe solely, then the world might become... this is going to be a negative statement. What I'm saying here is, if we don't understand the difference between those two kinds of love, then the world makes perfectly good sense. We can sort of understand what's going on in it. And I mean that for a lot of the reasons I did bring up in that second episode of this little series. Everywhere Arendt went, everywhere Hannah Arendt went, she saw only more of the competition and distrust and rejection of strangers that we most completely associate, not with every moment of human life, but with the tragedies of it, the crises, the moral crises that we bring up, like the Holocaust. We think of those moments as these exemplars of all of the evil of people competing with each other and destroying each other and wanting to keep everything for themselves. And we treat those moments as if they are anomalies. And they are, but they're only anomalies in scale. They're not anomalies of type. The alienation and subjugation and objectification of those who are different from us goes on apace, seemingly everywhere, all the time. We can't look anywhere without finding it present. And it becomes revealed not only in the negative experiences, well, I'm taking your parking place or honking at you when you're taking too long to get going at the red light, but even in the mutually interested exchanges that we make with each other. Well, I'm going to pay you $10. Oh, I can get it for $9? I'll only pay you $9 then. We have a self-interest even in the exchanges that we're doing that are a partial expression of exactly that same kind of using other people, the utility of others that's inherent to the nature of our existence in the world. If that's the case, then what I'm saying is that difference between the Holocaust and everything else we experience in life is only in scale. That's it. Now, again, I'm not trying to prove that point. I'm just saying it would be difficult to understand the point of the difference without introducing some radical element, some free agent that comes into the world and actually makes it different. If we don't introduce that, we can't get anywhere. And you can understand why then, when we hear about Christ, and I'll put it in non-Christian terms for a second, for those of you who are listening and going, well, it can't just be Jesus. I do think it's through Christ. And I do believe he's the only one who actually brings the real salvation, the real deliverance of this world from all of the morass it would be in otherwise. I do believe that. But I understand why people would look at it and go, but it's not just Jesus. A Mohandas Gandhi does the same kind of thing. Or within the Christian tradition, a Mother Teresa does the same kind of thing because they're introducing that kind of love. So regardless of what, or even a Henry David Thoreau in part of the setting of his life and so on. Even if you introduce all of those, just the idea that a person could be exceptional to the system of the world that just works the way it does and brings about what it does, and love and hate and all the other things in it are just features of that natural world. The possibility of a love different than self-interest's love changes my understanding of why God put me in the world. Just like I was saying, it gives us a way of looking at Christ like, man, he's this radical agent that comes into the world from a vector that's completely different than everything else in the world. No wonder he introduces so much change into the world. If that's possible, even in the one person of Jesus, then the point of this is it's not just possible, it's the purpose of every single person that God introduces into the world. Because all we're supposed to do is live out the righteousness of Christ. We're just supposed to live out what Jesus actually did. So it becomes suddenly this radical transformation of my understanding of why God put me into the world to begin with. I am now an agent, and by an agent, I mean someone who can introduce change, someone who can act freely in some way or another. So as an agent, I would have volition. I would have volition and therefore the ability to make decisions. You know, I have a will. And with that comes the responsibility that goes with it. There's the passage that I've discussed in a few previous episodes a long time ago, Ezekiel 18. I've probably mentioned it other times. I know I've mentioned it in places where I've preached recently. It's a really impactful passage, and it's famous to us because it says, the soul that sins, it shall die. Every soul is mine, and you know, that they all belong to the Lord. And the opening to that chapter, you know, you wouldn't have to think necessarily applies to what I'm talking about right now, because it's about how he gives the example of how, you know, the people of Israel saying, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. We're just being punished for what our parents did. And he says, no, that's not how it works. If a man does righteousness, then he receives the reward of it. If his son rejects his righteousness, then he receives the punishment for it. And if his son, the grandson of the original one, if he were to turn to right, or if he were to be righteous, then he would receive the reward of righteousness. The soul that sins is the soul that dies. Every soul is mine, says the Lord. That's the whole point leading down through the first 20 verses or so in Ezekiel 18. But then it changes. In that part of Ezekiel 18, he's simply making the point that every individual has competency before God and will stand before God as accountable for the decisions he made morally. He might make decisions to do this or that, he or she, but they're going to be accountable to God because every soul belongs to God. That's the point of that opening section. But the second part of the section is not about a father and a son and a grandson living the opposite life of the one who came before them. It suddenly changes in verse 21, and it introduces a new term altogether. If a wicked person, it says, turns away from all of his sins. He's not just wicked his whole life and therefore faces wickedness. He's a wicked person who turns away from his sins that he's committed, and he keeps all my statutes and does what is just and right. He shall surely live. He shall not die. And then he goes the other direction. And if a man has done righteousness and turns away from his righteousness toward wickedness, none of the righteousness he's done will deliver him. He will still be judged for his wickedness. And then he goes the other direction again. And there's a reason in context that Ezekiel is saying this to the people of Israel and that God is saying it to us because we love the idea, oddly, this is what we focus on. You would think we would love the idea that anybody could be forgiven for anything. But what we actually love is the idea that wicked people are going to be punished and that we're not among them. That's how we like to think of it. And so we don't like the idea that God's going to be nice to the people who've been cruel to us. You're forgiving them? Why are you forgiving them? We don't enjoy that at all. And so he's correcting them for that and saying, I'm not unjust. You're the ones who are unjust because when I have mercy on you, you're perfectly happy about it. You just don't like it when I have mercy on everyone else. And so I have mercy not only every single soul is mine, but then he has to say to them, every part of every soul is mine. So when a soul is sinning, I hold that person accountable for that moment in their life, which means in every single moment of our lives, we have agency. That doesn't mean, and I don't believe at all, that people are constantly acting freely. We're just constantly doing whatever we need to do. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's when we start to discuss what our sins actually are. We think of our sins as, you know, that breaking that commandment or breaking that commandment. But there's a broader way to think of sin. And I think it's a pretty significant way that we need to talk about in a minute, having to do with where we are and what we're just used to doing. So we'll come back to all that in a minute. While I would never pretend that we're constantly acting as radical free agents in this world, because we're not, you know, we're motivated by stimuli we're not even paying attention to. We're itching our face when we don't know we're touching our face. We're constantly doing things we're not thinking about. That's true. But morally, we have the agency to make choices, and we can act differently than we do. So I know a lot of people think that's weird. Determinists have a hard time thinking about that. If you'll hang with me, you'll know by the end, I'm not trying to squabble about the difference between determinism and free will. I am talking about the agency, the way Scripture talks about agency, whether you turn out to be a determinist or a person, or a libertarian, a person who believes in free will. It's not going to change the fact that we have to act on the basis of the choices God puts in front of us and expects us to respond to, and that we're held morally accountable for those choices. So this will work either way for you, so hang with me, even if you're a determinist out there. Okay, so here's the point. No jokes. I'm not throwing in a joke there. A joke was begging to be said, but it is not going to be said. I shall not do it. So as an agent, I have a will. I have a volition. I can make choices, which means I can have intention, not just some intent. Well, I'm trying to get to the other side of the lake. Yeah. I have intent, meaning I have something which I can bring to the table, which is a deliberate part of why I'm at the table. And I can act on that, not all the other things that are going on, not all the other dishes that are being passed around, not all the other people who are having conversations, but on the purpose, the intent that I have been given or that I have taken. Either one, doesn't matter. So I have volition, I have intent, I have the opportunity to think about the injection of change into this world, which is the only way you can make sense of the fact that when God puts mankind into the world in the person of Adam in the story, he's creating a person in the world who is supposed to exercise dominion. That's the idea of him representing God in this world, and he's in charge of the things that are happening. For Adam, for one man who comes into the world then, you know, it's a miraculous transformation that God works in the world. Everything before that could just have been particles in motion and wouldn't have made any difference. But once he introduces Adam into the world and says, now you are my image in this world. You bear the responsibility for it. You exercise authority in this world. It is a miracle when he puts that one person into the world and then introduces change. It's no longer just a machine. And again, even with God's constant involvement in it, the way that all those kinds relate to each other and reproduce and fill the waters and fill the sky and fill the land and all of that being present in the world is beautiful. It's majestic. It's glorious, but it doesn't have agency. It's just under the brooding of God. And then this man shows up. He doesn't give a command not to eat the fruit to any of the animals. The man shows up and he creates in the man agency, the ability to respond to a command by obeying it or disobeying it. In doing that, in this one person being introduced into the world, there is this miraculous transformation of the world into something where something can happen, something can change, something can be different, somebody can actually do something that is intentional. And then if you think beyond that, that one agent being thrown into the world and suddenly giving animation and life and purpose and direction and beauty and all of those things to the world, in that one person that comes into the world, if you think about it, after that, for each and every person he introduces into the world, that miracle is repeated. The miracle is exactly the same. And if you go beyond that, meaning this, God creates the entire world and he's not done until he puts a person into it. But person and persons are two different things because all the persons in the world are not just Adam. They're not all just clones of Adam. We're all different. Adam and Eve are involved in both. They produce these children, and one of them's killing another, and the other one is taking his place. And it's just this crazy array of individuals, all of whom have so much worth that every single one of them, not in toto, not just mankind bears the image of God, not just that, but Steve bears the image of God. That's a completely different kind of statement. We've talked about it ad nauseum, not quite. I'm not nauseated by it anyway. the moral distinction between price and dignity. And the reason human beings don't have a price, the reason slavery is so wrong, the reason the whole concept of just replacing one person with another is intolerable, is that God gave us dignity, not just price. We cannot simply replace one person with another person and expect the same thing because they're different agents. Every time God introduces a person into the world, this is the perpetual frustration of everyone who's ever had a child. We have a child, and we know what they ought to become. We know what they should be like. We know everything about what they need to do to be a success, and then they do everything else. What's wrong with these human beings? What's wrong with them is what makes them human beings instead of little animals for you to train. And I've seen little human beings trained as if they were little animals, and that's not what we're here for. The beauty of God introducing a new soul into the world, because in the same way that he looked at the world devoid of any human being and said, well, this is not done. I need to create a man. So here we're going to create Adam and Eve to make mankind. So now I've got Adam, I've got Eve. Oh, this is beautiful. Every single time. In fact, he did it with Eve. The very notion that God would look at Adam when he's created and say, now we need something more, means Eve was introduced into the world because something different needed to come into the world. Some change needed to be made in the world. God looked at the world and said, this is not good enough. How do I change it? I know. I create a person. That's what comes with every human being that comes into the world. And so for every single person who comes into the world, it has that same miraculous value. And not just for every person, but think about it. Every person has this almost unimaginably complex network of intersections with every other person in the world. So if you think about every one of those intersections and that unimaginably complex web of intersections that are created, brought about by every agent or person that God brings into the world, interacting with all the other agents that God brings into the world, then you start to get a glimpse of just how complex and beautiful the agency of persons in the world is, and how important it is that when you, as a person, act within the freedom and responsibility that God has given you, change the whole stinking world. That's right. It stinks. So now, let me just think about what this might mean. If agency is, now this is going down the sin route. In a way, this was illuminating for me. And it came to life in reading these books. So if agency is my purpose for being put into the world, and part of the demonstration, again, to be clear, of that agency is my ability to love in a way that's not just self-serving. I have the ability actually to give myself away. I have the ability to act within the altruism that God has created me for. Now, for a lot of people, you just don't believe that's a real thing. That's part of the discussion for today and part of the discussion for completely other days. I'll bring it up again in a moment. But if my agency is the reason God put me into the world, hey, I want this little creature to have some dominion in that world. So he's going to introduce ripples and waves that are going to change the rest of the world. And you can see why, whether you're a libertarian with about will like I am, or if you were a determinist or a compatibilist about will like so many other people are, it still is the same thing. God is saying, I'm going to change the world by introducing this soul into the world. And it's not like we know the future, so the agency for us amounts to the same thing. The way I respond to things, the way I act in the light of what's going on around me in the world, and the way I can choose to be on a vector that goes the opposite direction of where the rest of the world is going, is my opportunity to fulfill God putting me into the world so the world would be different than the way it was before I got here. That's what he's called us to do when we're coming into the world. So what if that's my purpose for being in the world, to exercise dominion, to show that agency, to have that intentionality, to fulfill the reason God put me here? If that's why he put me here, then what would be my sin? You know, what would be the indication that I fail to live up to the righteousness that God has called me to, that I fail to live up to the personhood that God has called me to be? And it would be not to exercise agency or not to have that agency. That would make me fail in my calling. If we're created as free creatures in the world to exercise dominion intentionally, then the opposite of that fulfillment would be, well, let's see, what term do you put on? The idea of not acting as a free creature to exercise dominion intentionally, but instead just to, you know, do whatever was coming next because you're part of the machine. I think the easy word for it for us, there are a bunch of different concepts that could fit into this category, but the easy one for us to understand individualistically, the way we normally think, is just habit. You know, if I'm living according to habit, then I am failing to exercise my agency. Why'd you do that? Oh, I didn't realize I was doing it. What do you know? I'm just a part of the machine, right? And again, 99% of the time, that's what we do. That I'm not saying every moment that you just happen to take a breath without intentionally taking the breath, lo and behold, you have sinned. That's not the point. In fact, if you'll think with me for just a moment, you'll get how important this becomes really quickly. In cultural terms, you know, our enculturation is our learning to internalize, to make natural for us, to make part of our superego, if I were doing this in Freudian terms, all of those external suppressions that the culture teaches us are important. Don't do this, don't touch that, don't eat that, don't wear those kind of clothes, or make sure you go there, make sure you speak this way to that person, whatever all those things are, that enculturation for me is a part of me just becoming part of the way the world already is. That's what enculturation means. You got to fit in with everybody here. You know, that's what you have to do. Well, obviously, it's important. We have to learn to speak the language of the people who are there. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, whatever. All of that's important. And yet, think about the trap it would put me into if that's all my life amounted to. If my life only amounts to enculturation, then I'm not going to exercise the agency or dominion or intentionality or transformative power for which God put me into the world to begin with. If we exist to be volitional, intentionally thinking, acting, willing, choosing agents, then the habit is the sin. And if in my community I become completely comfortable with all the things my community does because, hey, everybody does it, it's what everybody does and it's all I've ever known since I was a child, then my enculturation becomes my sin. We spoke about this in some previous episode when I was discussing Carthage and the sins that were committed there and how, you know, people wouldn't even have thought of there being a different option in that context. Most importantly, and because I'm doing this in the context of having read a book by Hannah Arendt, this one seems really obvious, evil, you know? So we think of evil as, oh, the man has horns and a tail and look at that, Satan is being realized in him and, oh, he must be throwing babies into the fire. You know, what a terrible time. I bet he just, you know, hates puppies. That evil, you know, that's what we think of with evil. Evil, if we recognize it as the privation of good, which is an Augustinian idea, right? So that's sort of built into Augustine. But evil, if it's the privation of good, if we're just not accomplishing what God put us here for, if that's all it takes for us to be evil, is just not doing the one thing he put us here to do, then the privation of good would be in that evil nothing more than me just living according to habit and enculturation. But wait, it gets more important than that. Because this phrase I'm going to introduce, some of you will recognize, I'm sure, immediately, but if you don't, I'll explain what I mean by it. If you think of evil in the Augustinian sense, you know that good is a thing. Good, righteousness, the holiness of God, the beauty of God, good is a thing. But evil, all of that, that's just the lack of good. It's not actually a thing in itself. It's one of the ways that in metaphysical terms, theologians find an escape route from the idea that God created evil, even though in Isaiah 45 he says he did. Whatever. The point is, it's a reasonable answer. It's a good answer. It's a Thomistic answer. It's also Augustinian. And so, you know, evil is really just the lack of good. It's not a thing in itself. It's a lack of the thing that God did create. It's like darkness isn't a thing. It's just the lack of the light that would be there. That's the comparison that's always made. Perfectly reasonable and really intelligent way to think about that problem. I use it all the time. I understand where it's coming from. If that's the case, and let's put it there for right now, that evil is a privation of good, then you can understand why we would be saying it would be evil if we lived our lives according to nothing more than the habits that we had to begin with, if the good that we were supposed to be in the world was the change that God introduced by creating our soul and putting us into the world. You hear that? That's a, you know, I hear you. I understand. If you're responding and going, that's too much pressure. That's way too much pressure. I understand that sense. But God didn't put you in the world and say, change every other person in the world by the enormity of the character and personality you're going to develop and the ability to create ingenious ideas that try and be. He didn't do any of that. He just said, be honest about the responsibility I put in front of you and the choice I ask you to make, so that when I say, just go there today, just do this one thing today, just care about that one person who doesn't care about you. Just make one choice to do something different than everybody else in the world would do right here. In that moment, if you just say, okay, I'll do that. And you don't even know what's going to come of it. The world has changed because a new wave was introduced to it. And God can handle the rest of where that wave goes. What he's put into the world to bring that change is you. If we understand that that's the good that comes into the world, then the privation of good, the lack of just doing something, just making a choice, just exercising your agency, that would become the evil. And that is an exact explanation of what's meant by this famous term that Arendt introduced in the mid-20th century at the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, which is the banality of evil. That evil is, you know, it's not what we think it is. It's not monsters perpetrating wickedness on the world. There are plenty of examples of that kind of thing we can think of. But even those people we characterize as these giant monsters who are afflicting the world in this way, even the reality of it is, if you sit down and have toast and tea with them, you know, you think they're just, and they would say, hey, I'm just trying to do the best I can. I'm just doing the thing we have to do. I mean, this is what people have to do in the world after all, and everybody's got to make tough choices, and somebody's got to be the man in the world and all that kind of stuff, and I've heard all of that language given to it. That's what it would be. The banality of evil is the idea that it's not giant monsters who perpetrate the evil on the world. It's human beings just like you and I are in the world. They do exactly the same thing. And we do exactly the same thing. And then we don't even recognize it. That idea would mean that if evil is the privation of good, it's exactly the same thing as saying evil can be banal. It can just be people doing the normal routines that they do every day, which is why even when the worst evils are going on, the Holocaust, the people who are participating in it are responding to questions about how they could be a part of that by saying, look, I'm not killing people. I'm just producing this gas that people come and collect from us. I'm not killing people. I just, as the famous expression goes, make the trains run on time. You know, that kind of idea. That's not the same expression. That one's about Mussolini and blah, blah, blah. But you get the idea. It's just I'm a cog. I'm a fixture. I'm part of the bureaucracy. I'm just part of the way the world is. The opposite of righteousness in the world would simply be filling your role, you know, doing your duty, you know, just following the habit that you've been given. And in your community, it would be the community's habit. Hey, my community does this. We think it's fine. No, okay, like Carthage, who offered their children up in sacrifice so they could win in war. That was their community's habit. And it is part of the evil that was in the world. And yes, an agent could have stood up in that moment and said, not my child. No, not going to do this. And they would have been condemned by their community for not caring enough about their community, but they would have been right. And they would have been exercising that ability to say, not me. This is different. This is different today. Now, again, I'm not presuming that just, you know, we can pick ourselves up, you know, as the expression goes, lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps. I'm not pretending we can do that. I know we don't obtain righteousness in our own merit. I know we don't have enough good works in us to accomplish anything. But that's the point of Christ having already come and having already risen from the dead and having already demonstrated his dominion lordship over the world and having invited us not just to see his lordship over the world, but to replicate it in the dominion he gives us in our responsibility to introduce a love into the world that's exactly like the love that he has already introduced in the world. So yes, I believe it only comes through Christ. I believe that's where we find it. But what we're finding needs to be recognized, which is this opportunity to do something different from the way the world is all of the other time, including all of that way that's worth celebrating, because there are so many beautiful things in the world of interdependency, so many beautiful things in a free market, so many beautiful things in the prosperity of an economy and the end of hunger when someone is able to eat because we were able to work and get paid for the food we produced that then fed them. I delight in all of that. It's beautiful, but none of it separates us from the machine, empty, meaningless, particle-filled, motion-filled machine that the world would be unless God introduced a person into it who actually said he loved someone because he meant it, not just because he got something back from it. And he did. In Jesus, that's the point, that in the Christian story, that's what we're imitating in him. So let me put it in this context, because I realize now I'm starting to run out of time, and this is the last of the three episodes that we're doing on this section. There is a built-in tension, right, between, and this is part of what Hannah Arendt talks about in her work, Love and St. Augustine. There's a built-in tension between the reach and grasp that people have. Even Augustine in his Confessions, I think, touches on this idea, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I do remember correctly, because I know when Descartes brings it up, you know, almost 1,000 years later. It probably is. It's about 1,000 years later. It's a little more than 1,000 years. When Descartes brings it up, you know, it's a stirring and stunning new idea. But in reality, Augustine had already talked about it. Not surprising, because Descartes, you know, is just as Platonic as Augustine is, for those of you who care about the philosophy. Anyway, the idea is that the way sin emerges is as, because God doesn't just create evil things, he's all good. So how would sin emerge? Because God creates us with a will and with power. And so including the power to understand things, but our power to understand, our power for doing things is less than our will. Our will can choose between anything, but our understanding can only grasp a certain amount. We have a certain amount of power, but then we have will that goes beyond that. And so the language that Robert Browning uses when he talks about this is the language of reach and grasp. But a man's reach should exceed his grasp. My grasp is what I can actually do. My reach is what I'm always thinking of. And because of that, we realize that mankind has built into him, no matter how much he has, a knowledge that he could do more. That no matter how much we've done, there's something else out there for us. And then Browning says it this way, or what's a heaven for? Meaning, why would you even be anticipating something that's better, something that's out there? Because there's always something better, no matter what we do here, which makes sense not only in a fallen world, but just in a world full of agents, in a world full of souls that God has created intentionally so that we can do something different here. So in one sense, then, that difference between the will and our understanding is the basis of sin, because, you know, we're not able to control how much we can produce or whatever. So yes, I promise I'm going to do that. And then some barrier comes up and we can't keep the promise. Part of the reason Jesus would say, let your yes be yes and your no, no. Don't bother with swearing. You don't own heaven and you don't own earth. So why would you do that, right? That kind of idea. But in another sense, it's not just the basis of sin, it's also the basis of our ability to love, which is fascinating, isn't it? That we can choose what does not serve our own interest. Our reach can exceed our grasp.
We understand what it means to love something within our grasp. We understand what it means to love something if we can understand what the product of that love is going to be. Oh, I'm going to love them because I know what's going to come out of that, or I know it's only going to cause this much pain, or I know it's going to result in this or that. But as human beings, we're put into the world with the ability to love beyond what we could control the outcome of. Because of that, this source for sin in the world is also the source for us to be able to love our neighbor, to introduce something different into the world. We can choose what doesn't serve our own interest. So in Augustine, it still does, you know, through the higher desire we have for God. We desire God, and so it introduces this change into the world. God's love is introduced into the world. But in Hannah Arendt, I think she does it a little, I mean, I know she does. She does it differently. And I think she sees in that higher love, that genuinely caritas kind of love for God, as Augustine describes it, an ability to neglect even the advantage for our own soul. She uses Paul in Romans 9, which is a perfect example. I could wish myself accursed from God for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. His desire is like Jesus' prayer. I don't want this, but I do want your will, Father. And so he chooses what he does in Gethsemane on their behalf. In these episodes that I did a long time ago on George Price and his pursuit of altruism in biology, you can look it up. I think we called it Happy Opposites Day or something like that. Those episodes, we did two of those episodes. We talked about altruism. I'm bringing it up here for this reason, that one of the significant observations that biologists were working on in the mid-20th century, same time that Hannah Arendt was working on this, which is definitely not a biological work, right? At the same time, they were trying to figure out altruism. What they concluded, one of the observations they made, and we talked about it in that series on altruism, Happy Opposites Day, was that greater altruism within a species, meaning you see animals taking care of each other, you know, like the elephants caring for each other and all that kind of stuff, that the greater altruism is in the species, that greater altruism actually meant greater alienation of other species. They had a sharper line dividing them from others, that alienation was an important part of maintaining altruism within the species, and so on. That's just part of biological nature. I'm saying that because at the same time when all of this profound research was going on in the biological world, in the search for altruism, Arendt is seeking the same thing, and so are a lot of other people. And let's not pretend that she just glibly discovers it. It's not like she writes this work and then it's like, oh, well, we got it. We got altruism licked. We got it figured out. This is how we can have it. But at least theoretically, meaning at least she's found what the theoretical object is, at least she can describe it, at least theoretically she's able to identify what the thing is we're actually looking for in love, in genuine altruism. Does she actually find it in the world? I think it kind of goes with her personality and her experience of life that, I mean, I don't know her answer to the question. I don't know what it would be. She may write it down somewhere, but I've never heard her say yes. And if you know the pains that trailed her life around, then you know that I mean, it's just as likely that she said, yeah, well, there's not any of it here. It would, if that were the case, and I'm not speculating on her behalf, but I'm saying it would make perfect sense to follow up on that kind of response with the same thing that Gandhi had said. You know, I'd be a Christian if I had ever met one. That would be the idea. That's, I think, kind of where Hannah Arendt is living her life. And by the way, during that same period of time, I think she's looking for where that difference in the world could finally be found. And if you go back to the first and second episodes of this three-part series, then you would know the experiences she had in life sort of testified, no matter where you go, people are still living in that competitive, alienated, isolating, rejecting, self-serving kind of world. And when they do love, it's because there's something in it for them. You know, that's a sad reality of what a lot of people experience in our world and what I think Jesus wants us to be better than, right? So let me conclude all of this with a few thoughts and especially point out this, that with all the quibbling, and I love the quibbling, between determinists and libertarians, I think we sometimes lose the main point of the discussion, which is what I want to make here. I think there are certainly ways, and I have no doubt about this. I know there are, because I know determinists who do this. There are ways for determinists to value exactly the same things that I'm talking about here. So I'm not taking a dig at that view. But the way I talk about it does entail a free will. That's just the way I talk about it, so don't hear this as me attacking determinism. I want to focus on the outcome of what that would mean. So from my meaning, a commitment to this kind of love. So from my side, I don't care about the theory or the metaphysics for their own sake. It's just that my understanding of why God puts us in the world requires me to see something beyond the natural world, that God has created us as something more than just a more sophisticated animal that happens to live in the world and get its stuff until it dies. When God saw the faults of the world, what I'm saying is, I believe this, when God saw the faults of the world and decided to introduce something into it to change it, he created you. You. A person who has the example, I believe the only example that matters to get here, the example of Jesus, to see that the world should be different with the gifts and talents and presence to serve the people he loves and the will to be different yourself. Then, so here we are. He puts us in the world and he says, now just change the world. You know, in other words, just be you. Just be the you I created you to be. Make the choice to love in the way I created you. I gave you a soul. I gave you the ability to do something that's not just respond to stimuli. Then do it, and then we all fail. We all do, including me, all of us. We fail all the time. We fail personally when we do no more than measure out our life in coffee spoons. We fail corporately when we do no more than enculturate each other with all the practices we expect to be made normative in everyone's life. But there is a journey back, and the journey back to fulfilling exactly why he put us in this world to begin with is no further back than that same story of Jesus that we saw in his example. But now we get to see in his redemptive act for us, meaning we begin the journey toward being what he created us to be by, you know, in Eliot's words, biting off the matter with a smile, squeezing the universe into a ball and rolling it towards some overwhelming question. I could spend a week talking about that phrase. But it's rolled toward a question because you don't know the outcome. You don't know the cost. And you bite it off with a smile saying, I don't know what this is going to produce, but I know it's what I was made to do. And so here I am doing it. We don't know the answer. We don't know the result, but we do know something. Redemption to become the intentional, volitional follower of someone who loved others at the expense of everything else. And so change the world. That's who Jesus is. So to close, I would just say that just imagine how different the world would be for the people you know. Forget everything else. It's just, you know, all you have is the waves you make right here. Think about how different the world would be for the people you know if they just found one person willing to care about them more than yourself. If the people, to put it in my language, I know, could just see in the world someone who cared about them more than I care about myself. Everything else I've said, all of the other philosophy, all the theology behind it, all the words of love and caritas and everything else, everything else I said may be obscured by a thousand convolutions, but this is not complicated. Love changes the world.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.